From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two perspectives on juvenile crime. John DiUlio is a Princeton professor who, with William Bennett, has co-authored a new book in which they argue that violent crime is not the result of economic poverty, guns, or the lack of prisons, but the result of what they call moral poverty, children raised in the absence of loving parents who teach them right from wrong. Also, we talk with the president and founder of the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives, Jerome Miller. He shut down all the Massachusetts reform schools when he headed the state's Department of Youth Services. He says much of the get-tough approach to juvenile crime is immoral and destructive. A discussion about juvenile crime coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former President George Bush is campaigning with GOP nominee Bob Dole in the key state of Florida today. Bush accused President Clinton of using the White House for partisan politics. For his part, Dole told the crowd this is an appropriate day for the president's campaign.
It's good to be in Tampa, and of course today is Halloween. All the kids are dressing up, doing scary things. That's the way it is in the White House every day.
Dole has renewed his attack on the president's economic policies and the administration's ethical difficulties. Dole says the Clinton White House has produced a scandal every week. Officials in Sao Paulo, Brazil, say all 95 people aboard a Brazilian airliner were killed today when the plane crashed into a residential neighborhood shortly after takeoff. The BBC's Michael Voss reports from Sao Paulo.
There were 89 passengers and 6 crew aboard the scheduled flight from Sao Paulo to Rio. The plane, a Fokker 100 from the Brazilian airline TAM, crashed shortly after takeoff into a residential area about 2 kilometers from Congonhas Airport near the center of Sao Paulo. A large number of black body bags can be seen lined up in the streets. A cloud of smoke hangs over the area as rescue workers continue trying to put out fires while sifting through the rubble in search of survivors. There was confusion this morning, as all initial reports said the plane was on a flight to the capital, Brasilia. It was only an hour and a half later that it was confirmed that the destination was Rio.
The BBC's Michael Voss. Bargainers for General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union worked all night in an effort to come up with a new contract. Walkouts by 7,500 GM workers at 2 Midwestern plants have forced another plant to close down. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
This was the first time current talks between the UAW and GM have gone around the clock. Usually that doesn't occur unless there is some hope that a deal is close, but neither side has commented on progress. It's believed they are still discussing a union demand that GM's employment level not decline by more than 5% over the life of the contract. That's something already agreed to by Ford and Chrysler, but GM has said it can't accept such a demand. As talks continue, so do the strikes at GM's Indianapolis metal stamping plant and at a truck assembly factory in Wisconsin. The company says part shortages due to the work stoppage in Indianapolis have resulted in the shutdown of another plant in Fort Wayne, Indiana. More than 2,000 workers there have now been laid off. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The Commerce Department says consumer spending edged up just 0.1% last month. That's the weakest showing in 3 months and further evidence of a moderating economy. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 10 points at 6,003 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 5 1/3 points. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. A Washington publisher will apparently deny the Pentagon's request not to put information on the Internet about Iraqi chemical weapons. The publisher is Bruce Kletz. He has told the New York Times that tomorrow he'll post more than 220 government documents on the Global Computer Network, documents detailing the possible release of Iraqi chemical and biological weapons near American troops during the Gulf War. The files first appeared earlier this year on a Defense Department site on the Internet, but the CIA complained and officials remove them. In Tokyo today, 600 children were evacuated from their junior high school, complaining of the effects of a mysterious odor. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
At least 130 children were taken to the hospital with symptoms of sore throats and stinging eyes after breathing in the foul-smelling fumes. The origin of the odor remains a mystery. A disaster prevention crew, police, and firefighters dispatched to the scene were unable to determine the source of the smell. A stain was found on the floor of a stairwell, but doctors at the hospital said the injuries were minor enough to rule out chemicals such as cyanide or chloride. Last year, in a series of incidents that authorities called copycat crimes of the Tokyo nerve gas attack, police discovered traces of mace released into the air. Japan remains jittery about reports of mysterious gas following the nerve gassing of the subways, for which the disbanded cult Aum Shinrikyo is now standing trial. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
A scientific panel has concluded that nearly two decades of research have produced no clear and convincing evidence that exposure to electric and magnetic fields in the home can affect human health. A committee of the National Research Council says a weak correlation was found between a rare type of childhood leukemia and some types of outside power lines, but experiments to try to confirm that connection have produced inconsistent results. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're facing a ticking crime bomb, warns my guest, John DiUlio. Most street crimes that frighten us are committed by men under the age of 25. And over the next decade, the number of young men in the population is going to increase substantially. He also warns that we're facing a new breed of young criminal, the super predator. DiUlio elaborates on these thoughts in the new book Body Count, about the war against crime and drugs. It's co-authored with former drug czar and education secretary William Bennett and criminologist John Walters. DiUlio is a professor at Princeton and director of the Brookings Institution Center for Public Management. DiUlio and his co-authors argue that the nation's drug and crime problems are fueled largely by moral poverty. I asked him to explain what they mean by moral poverty.
Essentially, by moral poverty, what we mean is children in need of adults, the problem of kids growing up without even a single adult in their lives, there to care for them, to nurture them, to teach them right from wrong, not a parent, not a coach, not a clergyman, no one. And we think that that factor, more than any other, although there are lots of factors that matter in driving juvenile crime and delinquency and drug use, that factor more than any other explains a lot of the recent increase in juvenile crime.
You say the moral poverty leads to lack of control and lack of empathy.
Right. One of the most disturbing things we see today is not just the total amount of juvenile crime out there, the 2.7 million arrests of juveniles in 1994, up from 1.7 million in 1991, and not just the fact that more of that crime, about 150,000 of those arrests in 1994 for violent crimes, but the remorselessness, the lack of conscience that is associated with some of those juvenile crimes. We think that there are basically two, if you will, character defects that define some of the worst of the worst of today's juvenile criminals. One is their sort of radical present orientation, the inability almost to think of or figure out any relationship between doing something now and being rewarded or punished for it later. And also their, in some cases, near total lack of empathy. They don't look upon other people, in some cases, as human. They don't feel joy at other people's joy or pain at other people's pain. And hence, they're capable, in some cases, of committing the most heinous acts without feeling any pangs of conscience. So that's our worry at the extreme.
So you're describing this problem of children in need of adults as being the problem of moral poverty. But what leads to that? I mean, a lot of people say what leads to that in the first place is hopelessness, long-term poverty, long-term unemployment, a lack of any connection with the larger social issues in America, because you're totally cut off economically, socially, where you live. So, I mean,
sure.
Do you see a connection between what you're describing as moral poverty and what other critics describe as
sure.
long-term economic poverty?
Sure. There's a connection. And there are at least there are a couple of different levels in which we need to understand this. In the first place, let's not compare. The easy comparison, I think the less interesting and important comparison, is between, say, kids in the suburbs who have parental supervision, go to decent schools, have jobs waiting for them, will probably go to college and are doing pretty well, and kids in the inner cities who have few, if any, of those things. Let's look within the populations within the most distressed, economically depressed areas of urban America. What we find there, pretty much consistently throughout the empirical literature, as well as the sort of ethnographic field-level, street-level studies, is that even in the case of kids who have every risk factor imaginable flicked on in their lives, they have no adult in the home who's supervising them. They've been abused, neglected, or they've witnessed serious up-close violence. They don't have a decent school. They have little, if any, job prospects. Their lives have been affected, either directly or indirectly, by substance abuse, whether alcohol or illegal drugs. Even among that population of kids, study after study shows that about half the kids are what the academic researchers like to call resilient youth. That is, somehow, some way, half of those kids, even in the most economically depressed circumstances, seem to get to age 18 more or less materially and spiritually whole. Now, the question intellectually and analytically is there anything we can identify in the lives of the kids who made it in those dire circumstances versus in the lives of the kids who didn't, that unlocks the key, that tells us how we might be able to replicate the circumstances of the kids who made it? Based on the research I've done, based on my own street-level experiences, I think there's an answer. And the answer is at the most micro level, that in the lives of the at-risk kids, the severely at-risk kids who made it, you almost always find one adult, could have been a coach, could have been a clergyman, could have been a teacher who stayed after school, could have been the lady around the corner who had three kids of her own and was a single mother but somehow was making it and opened her home. Could have been a safe haven that was created by some community organization. That child, that desperately at-risk child, found some adults, one or more adults, who were there for them. So that's so far as I'm concerned, is the silver lining in this cloud.
Now, you say that most street crimes are committed by men under 25, and that, therefore, demographically, America is a ticking time bomb. You say there's a new generation of street criminal, the youngest, biggest, and baddest generation any society has ever seen. You call them super predators. What do you mean by that? And back this up.
Okay. When we talk about the super predators, what we're talking about essentially are the kids who really are at the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier the 2.7 million juvenile crime arrests in 1994. That doesn't mean there are 2.7 million super predators out there, or even that most of those kids, as I said earlier, are even serious or violent or incorrigible in any way. But there is a phenomenon that we see, especially with respect to the development and the proliferation of serious violent street gangs in America, street gangs that now claim over 200,000 members nationwide, where you have more and more kids showing up at police stations, at juvenile lockups, who not only seem to be unconcerned about the crimes for which they've been charged, but seem to have no care either for themselves or for anyone else. We're talking about the kids who are guilty not merely of violence, but of the kind of gratuitous violence, the robbing of the person at the cash register and the senselessly shooting them for absolutely no reason, the drive-by shootings, the kids who do harm almost because, it seems in some cases, almost because they have no regard whatsoever for human life, either their own or anyone else's. Now, it's very hard to be very specific because we don't, in terms of the numbers or size of this population, I believe they're there because I've seen them up close and personal in juvenile lockups. I've talked to people, district attorneys around the country. There was recently a summit, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where a number of police officers will tell you much the same thing. People on the street now, inner city clergy, people are seeing these kids. And the so-called super predator is a term that was actually coined by an inmate, an adult inmate, whom I interviewed in a maximum security prison. When I asked a group of these inmates, what explains, in your view, and we're dealing here with a group basically of lifers, guys who grew up in the toughest of the tough streets of Newark and Camden, what explains the rise in juvenile violent crime? One of the inmates said, these kids are stone-cold predators. He said, crack killed everybody's mama. These are kids who are coming in here who scare us. They make us nervous and worried. So they're out there. They do not, however, define the entire juvenile crime problem. They define it, however, to the extent that it takes a very small number of such kids on the street, totally antisocial, deviant, delinquent, or criminal, to have a criminogenic impact, if you will, on all the other kids out there. They're the ones who, unless they're attended to, will turn the minnows and the guppies into sand sharks and into great whites. So that's the super predator concern.
Yeah, you say that a lot of people who you describe as the super predators don't see any correlation between committing a crime and getting punished. What would you like to see happen in the juvenile justice system that would reinforce that connection between crime and punishment, that you can't get away with hurting other people?
I think there has to be really a three-pronged strategy. And if you'll forgive the shameless alliteration, I talk about it as monitoring, mentoring, and ministering. The monitoring part is the part that the juvenile justice system can do best. When you get a kid who has taken a swing at the teacher but missed, and has done some other things, been truant, and maybe gotten involved in a few serious fights, and maybe he was caught with a concealed weapon, say a knife, not a high-tech gun. What we normally do with that kid today is we'll either, if the kid gets probation, he'll be on a caseload with a probation officer who will have many, many more cases that are much more serious and dangerous. So therefore, the minnow, the guppy in his caseload, is not going to get any attention. Yet we also know from the research that that kid, if the kid was hooked up with counseling services, if the kid's behavior was monitored effectively by some adult, that would make a difference. We need, therefore, to create programs like the one we've had running in Philadelphia over the past 10 years called the Youth Aid Panel Program, which involves the community directly in the administration of juvenile justice, where we have three-person panels from the community. Could be a local pastor, a local grocery store person, others who are involved in setting a disposition for a juvenile. The juvenile agrees to the disposition. Could be a curfew, could be writing an essay on the life and times of a public figure, historical figure. Could be get drug treatment. And that child is therefore spared, under current Pennsylvania law, which is like the law in many states now, a permanent criminal record if he or she completes disposition. We have preliminary data to suggest that 90% of those kids go away and don't come back.
Some experts are saying that the criminal justice system, particularly the juvenile justice system, is racist, that young African-American men are being disproportionately punished, particularly as a result of the war on drugs. What some critics say is that the war on drugs has really been a war on young black men, and that if white middle-class kids were using crack, that they would be given drug rehabilitation programs and education programs and so on. They wouldn't just be thrown in prison, but because the crack epidemic has been mostly among, you know, poor people and many African Americans, that prison is seen as the social solution, and young black men get swept up into this cycle of a system that's just going to toughen them more and then make it even harder to get a job when they get out, mm-hmm. making it even more difficult to become a part of legit society.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
See, I have a there's two levels in which to address that. First of all, I have absolutely no disagreement whatsoever with the view that if children in suburbs and mostly predominantly white suburbs, if where I teach at Princeton University, if we had anything like the level of criminal victimization, exposure to juvenile victimizations that we have in, say, Camden, New Jersey, that you'd have a commitment of resources and time and investment and energy that you simply don't see. And that commitment would not just be to more police and to more prisons and to more juvenile facilities or better juvenile probation, but there would be a concentration of minds to find out what's going wrong. I have no qualm with that, nor do I have a qualm with the view, which I think if you're awake and alive and live in this country, you have to be aware that there is a greater degree of police attention, to put it somewhat euphemistically, devoted to young African-American males who may be walking down the streets of Princeton, New Jersey, who will be hassled or stopped more often, other things being equal, by police than their white counterparts. There's in the black community in Philadelphia, sometimes joked about the crime of DWB, driving while black. This happens in America. It's real. It's a part of our legacy. But having said that, the data, and I think there have been studies by the National Academy of Sciences and others, when you look at the behavior of the justice system once people are brought in, arrested, booked, conviction, post-conviction dispositions, there's really little or no evidence of any systematic racial bias post-1972. Now, the death penalty is a separate issue. But in terms of the adjudication process, there's really very little evidence of systemic and systematic racial disparities in sentencing.
My guest is Princeton professor John DiUlio, co-author of the new book, Body Count. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the war against crime and drugs with John DiUlio, co-author with William Bennett of the new book, Body Count. I want to get back to one of the basic premises of the new book that you co-authored, which is the theory that a lot of crime and a lot of the drug problem in America has to do with moral poverty. When you use the term moral poverty, it sounds like what you're talking about is defects within the individual, as opposed to a larger social, political, economic environment that has put people at an incredible disadvantage and has led to the breakup of the family and has led to poor education and has led to unemployment and hopelessness and a lack of investment in the larger society and so on. Is that what you're saying, that there's some kind of flaw in the individual that is removed from larger social and economic problems, including racism?
No, we're saying we're as much antithetically opposed to that position as we can possibly be, because the conception of moral and morality that we employ in the book and that we intend when we use the term moral poverty, to us, you know, there is a school of thought that, without getting us sidetracked into modern political philosophy, that represented by Immanuel Kant and others, where essentially morality and things moral inhere in the individual. But there's an older tradition, a classical tradition, an ancient tradition, which stretches back at least to Aristotle, in which our moral sentiments, our moral sensibilities are shaped by those around us, in particular by our teachers, by our parents. And so we are made moral. So our conception, if anything, it's much closer to the quintessentially mid-century sociology notion of bad boys from bad homes, essentially what we're talking about.
Let me give you an example that I've often heard mentioned by guests on this show. You take a parent who can't get a job at all or doesn't have a job that could pay well enough to support the children and the rent, and ends up turning to selling drugs, turns to the black market instead of the legit market because the black market pays better and there's more opportunity there. There's a job opening in the black market and not in the legit market. So obviously the children are going to be learning lessons about that the crime can pay, that the legit world often doesn't pay or doesn't pay enough. But on the other hand, what has led to that lesson, the lack of opportunity in the legit world? So where does moral poverty fit in?
Well, I take, and I think my co-authors of this book take strong exception to that argument, and for reasons that some of the people who make those sorts of arguments, I think, need to pause and consider or reconsider. When people assume that poverty causes crime, and that kind of poverty, joblessness, hopelessness leads, most poor people, including most poor people living in today's American inner cities, are not criminals, do not commit crimes, and are really are heroes and heroines. They struggle. Most people, under most conditions, struggle to get up in the morning, to find work, to get to school, to run the gauntlet of streets that are often drug and crime infested. These are the heroes and heroines. Even among populations of single-parent families where there's either no work or people are chronically welfare-dependent, you have families that are every bit as much intact and struggling to make it and aspiring. Now, when we excuse, even implicitly excuse, the behavior of people who say, well, I can't make it. It's easier to sell crack to my neighbors and my neighbors' kids than to, you know, struggle with this, to overcome this adversity, to honor whatever religious or spiritual commitments I have. That person's behavior needs to be made. We have to heap moral opprobrium on that person and say, there are no excuses.
One more question about moral poverty. Some critics, I'm sure, would say that the larger moral poverty is our social policies' moral poverty, that we should be cutting poor people off of welfare and saying there's a finite amount of time in your whole life that you can have government assistance, that your children can. People would say that's reflective of a larger American moral poverty.
Well, I here have to be very clear that I'm speaking for John DiIulio and not my co-authors in saying that I strongly oppose the notion of welfare time limits. I think it is a mistake on many different levels. In the city of Philadelphia, which is my hometown, the city I know and love best, we have 42% of Pennsylvania's aid to family with dependent children cases. Most of the people on welfare are children. It is in the nature of children to be dependent. The cities, in many cases, simply do not have the tax bases and cannot afford to support these kids. We do not have the jobs. We are losing jobs, not gaining them, especially low-skilled jobs. So there is people need to transcend the usual, I think, liberal, conservative, ideological boundaries. We need to recognize that not only is the dependent population concentrated, the kids who will be on welfare in one form or another for 5 years or more before reaching age 18, but even the violent crime here is concentrated in the lives of these dependent youth. It is true, for example, that of the 150,000 juvenile violent arrests that I mentioned earlier in 1994, that would tell you about 0.5% of an entire cohort of juveniles will ever be, getting in trouble for a serious or violent crime. And that'll tell you that most of the serious or violent crime is concentrated in a handful of states or places. Now, the question for this nation, both in terms of welfare policy, social welfare policy, and crime policy is the fact that these problems, the welfare dependency problem, the need for financial support problem, the violent is concentrated. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that a cause for alarm or complacency? I view it, and here I'm speaking for my co-authors as well, as a cause for alarm. The fact that these problems and these populations are so heavily concentrated in particular places, and the fact that the rest of us can so easily walk away from them, not drive by these places, move to gated communities, hire more rent-a-cops, target hard-and-hour environments, shop at exurbanized shopping malls, this is part of the problem. So I strongly concur with the sentiment that it is wrong to denationalize citizenship anywhere, most especially among where the targets of those policies are at-risk children.
John DiIulio, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John DiIulio is co-author of the book Body Count. He's a professor at Princeton and directs the Brookings Institution Center for Public Management. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, alternatives to locking up juvenile criminals. We talk with Jerome Miller. When he headed the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services, he was appalled at the sadistic treatment of youth in the reform schools, so he shut them down, replacing them with community programs. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of our solutions to the problem of juvenile crime are only making matters worse, warns my guest Jerome Miller. In fact, about 25 years ago, he shut down all the reform schools in Massachusetts when he headed the state's Department of Youth Services. Since then, he's been asked to reform criminal justice programs in several states. He's directed the Illinois and Pennsylvania Departments of Children and Family Services. He was the court-appointed monitor of prison and jail overcrowding in Jacksonville, Florida. In 1995, he was appointed by a federal judge to reform Washington, D.C.'s foster care program. Miller is also the founding director of the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives. Miller told me when he took over the Massachusetts reform schools in 1969, he found the school's approach to punishment was sadistic.
It was all over the place. I mean, kids being tied to beds, hog-tied, in the nude, in isolation cells, a lot of beatings. It was just a pretty horrific system. It was held together by a hammer, if you will, as most of these state systems are, and that was one particular cottage, discipline cottage, at one of the larger institutions. It was always the threat. If you didn't make it well in the system and conform, you could end in that cottage. In that cottage, no one was ever allowed to speak. You sat across from other inmates at tables and just looked at one another. Scrub floors with toothbrushes. We're locked in isolation. Anyone who did speak could be pretty well beaten. All of this sort of thing. And it had gone on for many, many years. Now, it did stop escapes from the institutions. It stopped runaways. But I think the long-term effects of that, in terms of what it reflected regarding the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services and indeed our society, I think were pretty dismal.
But now that level of punishment is supposed to be there as a severe disincentive for further misbehavior or breaking of the rules. Did it not function as a disincentive? And how did it change the young people?
It would stop. Being brutal will stop runaways. When I was in the midst of the reforms, you know, we had a lot of problems within the institutions. Obviously, when you close down a discipline cottage and that kind of brutality, the message kind of gets out that perhaps you can get away with many things. And indeed, the staff, I think, encouraged it. Escape maps were posted. Staff administrators were telling youngsters in the facility that there are no rules, you can do whatever you please with this new commissioner, and they were kind of invited to run. At one point, the staff walked out and threw a bunch of keys down the hallway to the inmates, so that we had a great deal of turmoil in trying to reform them. But once we got through that, I think it was much the better. I mean, I looked back 6 or 8 years before my arrival. One day, my secretary, who'd been there many, many years, kind of casually threw a folder on my desk and said, you might be interested in this. And it was a year in which they'd had virtually no runaways from that very large institution in central Massachusetts. And what the folder contained were the names and the descriptions of what had happened to a number of the runaways. And that is that their ring finger, when they came back, their ring finger had been bent back over the top of their hand and broken. And this had, they'd broken a number of kids' fingers, and obviously that stopped runaways. But that's really not the issue. I think that if you have a decent program, most kids will stay with it. We had a time at which kids were running from these facilities down to my office to tell me what was happening, and I couldn't in conscience return them to the facility. We would start placing them in other places around the city or in group homes or in foster placements or indeed sending them home with other services, because I said, if I were in that facility, I wouldn't want to stay either. There's no reason to. And then if you looked at our recidivism statistics, which were recidivism rates of repeat crime were very, very high among the kids graduating from these places.
Well, now, when you shut down the Massachusetts reform schools, what did you do with the young people who were in there? Where did you send them?
Well, unlike the mental health deinstitutionalization, where all the money and resources stayed on the hospital grounds while all the patients were thrown out into the community with no services, ours was just the opposite of that. We ensured that the money we spent for kids in the state institution followed them to the community for alternative services. And we were spending a great deal amount of money. For example, today in the average state reform school in this country, it's costing between $60,000 and $80,000 per kid per year In New York State, it's over 76, 78,000. In Pennsylvania, the system I ran there, it was close to 80,000. In Maryland, same. I mean, this is true nationally. And then the question you have to ask is, if I had a troubled teenager in my family who were in trouble, most of these kids are not violent, incidentally, and I was going to help them, would I take $75,000 of my own money and give it to this awful facility as the best way of guaranteeing public safety or of lessening the chance that the kid might repeat the crime? And of course, no one in their right mind would. But it seems that we're willing to spend humongous amounts in destroying the children of the poor, much more than we'd be willing to spend on our own kids, or indeed could spend.
In your experience, what are some of the alternative institutions that are most effective in dealing with juvenile offenders?
For example, the model that I think has worked among the best was a model in which we would hire people, pay mm-hmm. them something approaching a full salary to care for one kid. Or perhaps have a caseload of more than three or four, where we could account for that kid every 24 hours in a face-to-face meeting at least two or three times, sometimes up to five times. Other alternatives were specialized, what in child welfare they'd call specialized foster homes, but we didn't call them that. These were people that we hired, again, paid to take a kid in and to be with them. If there was a problem with the kid going to school, they had no other job but to go to school with that kid and sit in the back of the classroom. We had specialized group homes, specialized drug treatment programs, outward bound programs. There are just so many things that one could do. I think if you had $75,000 in hand to treat a particular delinquent, you'd get very, very creative about the possibilities there. And even if you fail, you know, with those you fail, it seems to me it's a bit better to fail at trying to do something decent and humane rather than to have the equal failure rate or a higher failure rate by being punitive.
What about public safety? One of the reasons why young offenders are locked up is to protect the rest of society from them. If they're in halfway house kind of programs where they're partly reintegrated into the community, is the community at risk?
I think that's the tack that many conservative commentators would take, that the main purpose these days of incarceration is to incapacitate the person, to keep them from recommitting their crime. And there's some truth to that. If a person's locked up, it's less likely they're going to slip and have a criminal act than if they're in an open setting where this can more easily happen. But I think it's kind of ostrich-like behavior, because in fact we aren't going to lock people up forever, and when they come out, if they come out a bit more dangerous, and certainly most of the research suggests that, I don't think we guarantee that much more public safety. And in fact, the National Council on Crime and Delinquency study in Massachusetts did not find that we threatened public safety at all. Murders didn't go up, burglaries didn't go up, assaults didn't go up. In fact, they went up at a lower rate when they did go up at a lower rate than in those states that continue to rely upon the larger institutions. So that I don't think we endangered public safety at all. I think the greatest danger is what we're doing in this country now. It'll come back to haunt us in a few years. I guess if one wants to lock up everyone who's potentially going to get involved in using drugs or breaking into homes and all, I guess we could get a respite for a while. But wait till that whole wave starts to return to the streets. And I think that's what we're doing now, particularly with the African-American young men and boys in this country.
I think part of the motivation behind the Get Tough movement is the feeling that young people need to learn that when they break the law, there are consequences and they will be punished harshly. If you take away the harshness of the punishment, does that diminish the message that you're sending a would-be offender?
See, that reasoning makes great sense for a kid raised in a together family that's had a fair amount of love in their lives, a fair amount of opportunities available to them. But that makes very little sense to the average kid, most of whom are poor, most of whom come from destroyed families of one sort or another who entered the juvenile justice system. To talk about punishment as the means of holding them in line and the only way to do it, it's no news to them. These are kids that generally have been punished throughout their lives, often erratically so. They know about consequences. It just adds adds more hate to the whole issue. And the state doesn't give punishment well. You might, a parent certainly can, and they can set limits and be rather punitive, and the kid will perceive it as an act of love and concern. I don't think that's ever true in a large state institution. It's seen as an act of hate, and very often it is just that. We tend to, these days, I think, to get ever more vicious. I don't know where it's going to lead us as a country. I fear it's leading us in some frightening directions.
But here's the question. If young people are committing crimes, you don't want to just look the other way. I mean, there has to be consequences for breaking the law. Well, now, you're saying that the prison is the wrong consequence. It teaches the wrong lesson. So what do you think should happen instead?
Well, I think we should rely much less upon the criminal justice system, particularly in the teen years. We should rely more upon child welfare models, around psychiatric models. We should put much more pressure on our human service professionals and agencies, most of which are funded by government funds, to be open 24 hours a day, to be out there to help, have street programs, preventive programs. There are just so many things we could be doing short of this. But it doesn't seem that we want to do that. We've, I think, made a decision as a country that we're going to handle what are essentially personal, family, economic, employment problems, and a wide range of other problems, that we're going to handle these problems through the juvenile justice or criminal justice system by drawing lines in the sand and whacking people when they cross them. That'll work for a while. But the so-called broken window theories eventually turn into broken head theories. And that's, I think, where we're heading.
Jerome Miller is my guest. His latest book is called Search and Destroy: African American Males in the Criminal Justice System. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerome Miller. When he was the commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services, he shut down all the state's reform schools. He founded the think tank, the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives, which consults with prisons and jails about overcrowding and develops sentencing alternatives to imprisonment. And he was also appointed by the court in Washington, D.C. to head the child welfare system. Jerome Miller, we've been hearing talk about a so-called new breed of young offender, someone who's tougher, more violent than his or her predecessors, a so-called super predator with no empathy, no conscience, no sense of right and wrong. In your experience, is there a new breed of young criminal?
Emphatically, no. I think there has been a rise in homicides, which thankfully is now going down among juveniles. I think objective researchers, such as Al Blumstein up at Carnegie Mellon, have concluded that the increase in juvenile homicides is virtually totally relatable to the availability of handguns, that formerly simple beefs between youngsters now turn into potentially lethal events because there are so many handguns on the street. But I don't think there's a so-called new breed. There have always been a certain percentage of kids who are so damaged that they are very, very dangerous, have very little feelings for others, and it's not a large percentage, but they've always been there, white, black, whatever. But there is no new breed. And there's been all this hype to create, if you will, a new kind of violent juvenile that's out there to get us all, when at a time when juvenile crime rates are actually falling, including violent juvenile crime. I see it as primarily racially driven, and I think it's reflective of a sea change in the country with reference to our incarceration rates. For the first time in our history now, close to 75% of people going into state and federal prisons as well as into our juvenile facilities are either African American or Latino. That is just turn things on its head. If you would go back to 1930, it would be 75-80% white, and the others either African American or Latino. And that has changed all the rules of the debate, because I think in the average white person's mind, when we hear super predator juvenile, what they see is a black or a brown face. And I think they are inspired to see that by some of the phony research that's being bandied about on this. And I think it's very troubling.
What about the argument that a combination of crack and guns has created a super predator?
Well, I guess in some cases one could make that case, but I think probably you could make a stronger case that the drug war has created those kinds of situations in which turf battles lead to events that are very lethal. I don't know that there's that much evidence that people on drugs are that much more violent across the board. Certainly there are incidents of that with crack addicted particularly, but I would doubt you'd be able to show that the numbers of violent incidents associated with crack are anything like the number of violent incidents associated with alcohol. Most of the violence associated with drugs in this country is not because of people pumped up on drugs. Some of it is, but most of it is not. It's turf wars. We should never forget that the criminal justice system is of its nature a hostile procedure. It does not heal anything. It alienates, it marginalizes, and in fact, I think that's what we're using our correctional systems for these days. It's to manage populations who are increasingly marginalized in our society with no jobs, very little hope, and what are we going to do? I think we're going to retreat to camps, prisons, detention centers. We're hearing now about the single mom, meaning I think in most people's minds a single African-American mom. We're talking about removing some people, suggesting as many as 500,000 kids from these facilities to be placed, originally they were saying in orphanages. When that became kind of a bad word, they started talking about resocialization facilities and group homes. It's a very ominous turn of events, and it's ill-informed. It's based on stereotypes and fears, and I kind of fear where we're headed.
For a year, you and your wife took into your home a 15-year-old boy who was convicted of killing, I believe, his mother and his 8-year-old stepbrother.
Yes. We've done that over the years. We've had another youngster who'd killed his father. These are decisions you make. Some work out, some don't. But you.
What motivated you to do it?
Well, in this particular case, he wasn't doing it all well in an apartment situation which he was living. He was not getting in trouble, but he was becoming very hermit-like. He'd been sent away into a state prison, and where he had been sexually assaulted. And really, I don't think to this day has undone the damage done there. And then there had been other damage previously in his own family with reference to sexual abuse. And, you know, you try your best with these. As I say, sometimes they work out. This young man's presently having some other major problems, not in terms of violence, but some other major problems. But, you know, I've always done that. I was up to Massachusetts a couple of weeks ago to talk to a group, along with some of the other commissioners that succeeded me there. And I looked out into the audience, and there sat a young man now in his mid-30s who I remember my wife and I taking in when he was on the run from one of the institutions that I ran at the time because I just couldn't in my heart send him back there. And we put him up with us for a couple of days till I could find some other option. And I guess it worked out okay.
There's a new book about crime, whose co-authors include John DiUlio and William Bennett, that makes the case that today's crime problem and drug problem among young people is largely a result of, quote, moral poverty. That is, that young people are growing up in homes in which right and wrong isn't taught, in which there might only be one parent, in which that parent might even be a drug dealer, and the children aren't being given a sense of conscience, a sense of right and wrong, a sense of social connection.
Well, I'd suggest to Mr. Bennett, Mr. DiIulio, that when they're looking for moral poverty, they look to the suburbs first, and they look to those people of means who I think have more of the power in this society and should deal with their own problems first. That's not to suggest there is not all sorts of problems, are not all sorts of problems in the inner city and the poor communities, but it ill behooves these folks to be making these kinds of judgments. I do not agree that the black family is that destroyed or destructive. There are so many strengths, even among single mothers on welfare, and there is this tremendous amount of stereotyping that goes on. There are problems in the cities, as there always have been. If you look at the murder rate in San Francisco in the late 1800s, when there were virtually no African Americans living in the city, they were much higher than they are today. If you look at the murder rates in New York in the 1920s or 1910 or 1890s, you know, if you look at the arrest rates among juveniles in the back of the yards in Chicago, and the famous studies done by Clifford Shaw of that era, the arrest rates among Irish and Polish kids was every bit as high then as it is today for African American kids. The majority were in fact being arrested and booked and given criminal records, but it's always been different for blacks in this society.
My guest is Jerome Miller. He's written a new book called Search and Destroy: African American Males in the Criminal Justice System. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerome Miller. He's headed juvenile justice programs in several states and now heads Washington, D.C.'s foster care program. You say that there are consequences when we take a lot of young people who have committed property crimes, crimes that aren't terribly violent crimes, and we put them in the criminal justice system where they're exposed to more toughened criminals. What are the consequences, do you think, to society in the long run?
We've created on our streets, particularly in our inner cities, because of our tremendous use of this system to deal with problems, we've created on the streets the subculture of the maximum security prison or the state training school. Anyone who spent time in any of those facilities will know what I'm talking about. When we hear about someone being shot over their athletic jacket or over their sneakers, or we hear about drive-by shootings, those are all seen as irrational crimes. You know, there's no reason for them, and in a sense, there should be no reason for them. But if you know much about the subcultures of these facilities that we move these hundreds of thousands of folks through, in those facilities, that sort of behavior is the norm. Now, there aren't guns there, so that it isn't a matter of people being killed at that level, but the behavior patterns are there. For example, if you mouth off to someone, call them a name, whatever, you learn very quickly in prison or in a reform school that you'd better darn well back that up with some action in terms of a violent action, a broken nose or something. Because if you don't, you will become fit for being a punk. You will become a potential victim. So you learn a whole pose. You learn a whole pattern. You learn how to front, if you will, in front of your friends, to sound tougher than you are. And that's carried out into the streets. And then another thing you learn in prison is never to snitch. But then when we look at the drug war, which relies so much on snitches, on getting people, arresting people, charging them with rather heavy charges, offering to cut the charges back if they'll turn in others, often friends, relatives, whatever, that has a debilitating effect eventually, because you don't know if you're a young person on the street whether someone around you is a snitch for the narcs or not. And the way you prove your sense of integrity is by being violent in front of them. This country spent somewhere near $500 million paying snitches one recent year, so that it's an endemic sort of thing. Now, I can understand it may be necessary with drug kingpins, et cetera, but we're destroying whatever minimal fabric of social cohesion there was in the community by turning everyone very, very paranoid.
You were appointed by the court to head Washington, D.C.'s child welfare system. So you're now overseeing the foster care system.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C. What are your goals there?
Well, they're not all that dissimilar from some of those in the juvenile justice system. I hope to humanize it, to individualize it, to bring care to kids who are abused and neglected, to get a lot more treatment programs for substance-dependent moms. I'm certainly not going to go to the direction of trying to drag kids out of homes willy-nilly. We don't want to put anyone at risk, but I'm not here to destroy single parents who are much maligned. Many of these women are trying their darndest with very little at hand and very little means to do it and very little support. So that we'll take a careful approach, but I want to make a system that people can be proud of and be something of a model. One of the things we're going to do is move it much more to the community with community people in control, so that if you have an allegation of a neglect or an abuse on a block, I'd like the local church to know about it, and I'd like women and others in the neighborhood to know about it, so that we could get in there and do what we can. If the child has to be removed, certainly that will happen, but we need to get other services and supports. Unfortunately, that hasn't been happening here, and I'm very hopeful we can do that. We've had some very good support from, obviously, from the court and others. I was appointed by a very conservative judge, appointed by Ronald Reagan, in fact, and he's just been marvelous because he's a father and a very decent human being, and he sees these things in human terms.
Jerome Miller is now the head of Washington, D.C.'s foster care program. He's also the founding director of the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives. His new book is called Search and Destroy: African American Males in the Criminal Justice System. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Lawrence Donahue Green. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.